The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
We start right here in Israel, where hundreds of Palestinians have clashed with Israeli police Wednesday night and also into Thursday morning. That happened in several locations across East Jerusalem while forces continued to hunt for a Palestinian suspected of a deadly shooting attack on a checkpoint just days earlier. Protesters blocked roads. They also threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at police and launched fireworks and set tires and garbage dumpsters on fire. Two police officers have light injuries from that. Well, a Jewish family with toddlers also survived a lynch attack on their car after attempting to drive to Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem. And earlier on Wednesday, police said Palestinian gunmen opened fire at a border police position at the Kalandia crossing near Jerusalem. Troops stationed there also returned fire, but police made at least five arrests over the rioting, which is some of the heaviest the city's seen in over a year.
Some of the worst violence that Jerusalem has seen in over a year, and there's no indication that it's going to die down. Jerusalem, of course, is a very important city. It's one that we are chosen to, or that we constantly need to watch the events that are going to taking place there. And today's program will almost entirely be about Jerusalem, including something very special on the second half of today's program. We'll be hearing from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, in an address that he gave on September 4th to about 80 people in Jerusalem at the opening of the Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology. A lot of people have requested to see this opening. It was not streamed live online. It was only those really that were there at the time that got to watch it. And on today's program, on the second half, you stick around for it, we'll be listening to Mr. Flurry, watching Mr. Flurry's address. I'll get into that as we go. Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Brent Nachtigall, filling in once again. Wasn't planning on filling in 2 days in a row, but here we are nevertheless. And it just so happens that just a lot of violence is taking place in Israel right now, especially in Jerusalem. And what I'm going to do today is go through a couple of stories that show some of the reasons of why this violence is increasing right now. Of course, violence in Jerusalem, I think we are numb to it in many ways, because if your historical memory goes back any length of time, you'll know that this is something that has happened through millennia, and even with the Israeli state itself, numerous, two very serious intifadas taking place in the early 90s, early 2000s, and then other increases in violence over the past almost two decades now. And so we want to talk about this and watch it and not become numb to it, because biblical prophecy talks about violence in Jerusalem and a specific event as the first domino to fall as we watch for Jesus Christ's return. This domino, or this event that we're watching for and have done so for the past 30 years really, is half of Jerusalem falling underneath Arab control, really Iranian-inspired Arab control. And when we see violence happening, and this is, I mean, of course the Israeli military is far superior, I'm not saying that at all, however, when we see violence increase like this throughout the West Bank, this area that is still under military control, a lot of it by Israelis, a lot of it is under Palestinian Authority control. When we see violence spiraling out of control there, where the mass of Arabs are in Israel, what we have to recognize is that the West Bank borders East Jerusalem. If you're talking about what East Jerusalem is, it's this line of division that's basically a line in the sand today, or a street or a road. There's no actual fence between East and West Jerusalem. But it's the area that Jordan, or this dividing line, was the area that Jordan occupied from 1948 through to 1967. You'll remember when Jerusalem was cut in half, and then after the Six-Day War in 1967, then the nation was united. So half of that Jerusalem was Jordanian territory pre-1967, and so that's what we mean with East Jerusalem. So you've got the West Bank and East Jerusalem, part of Jordanian territory, and you have most international bodies, including this current administration of the United States, that believes that Israel has no legitimate right to inhabit East Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem, if you're familiar with some of our archaeological digs that we've been a part of, that's where ancient Jerusalem is. And so imagine how ironic it is that Judah, or the nation of Israel today, if the United States had its way, would be cut off from the capital that David set up, the most famous, well, probably the second most famous Jew in history. That would be cut off if the Obama administration, Biden administration had their way. And so just separating ourselves from that, though, the violence and the ease at which you have Arabs being able to rise to the surface, violent Arabs, terrorists inside the West Bank, and push up against East Jerusalem, I think it's quite shocking that it still takes place. And there's several reasons for that. I have an article here by Jonathan Speier. He's one of the great writers for the past two decades about Israel's security, watching Iran in Syria, the Kurds, elsewhere. He's a Jerusalemite, just lives around the corner from where I live. He wrote an article, "A Dangerous New Generation of Militants is Rising in the West Bank." So prophecy says East Jerusalem will fall, directly preceding, or it starts a domino effect that is going to lead to the coming of the Messiah, the return of Jesus Christ. And it takes place, and this violence foments inside the West Bank, where it's increasing right now. Something new is brewing in the northern West Bank. In recent months, the cities of Jenin and Nablus, the Israeli authorities in those cities, the Israeli authorities have observed the emergence of novel and unfamiliar forms of armed Palestinian political organization. So different to the Fatah-led terrorists and the Hamas terrorists, these guys look like they're loosely associated. And what's the thing that unites them? We'll see. These new structures are only loosely associated with existing Palestinian political movements. They represent the coming of age of another generation committed to a broadly Islamist political outlook. So this Islamist political outlook means that Islam deserves and should rule over the lands that it was once over. It should not accept foreigners in the lands that were once captured by Islam, by Islamic powers. And they believe that the government should be Islamist. With no interest or reference to diplomatic processes and supporting a strategy of armed insurgents, this gathering represents a fresh challenge to both Israel and the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority. I think most people don't really realize this, but Mahmoud Abbas, he's the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen, as they call him in Israel. He leads Fatah, the political party that grew out of the PLO, the successor to Yasser Arafat. And right now, he's trying to, in many ways, trying to stop these political factions from rising because they jeopardize his own rule, even inside the West Bank. I don't know how much power he has to really implement some of the things he wants to, given his age and given that he's extremely unpopular. However, you have both Israel and the Palestinian Authority really worried about what's taking place. Further on, it says this, Jonathan Speier, "The result is a rising arc of violence. It began during Ramadan earlier this year." This was just before we had our excavation there in just south of the Temple Mount wall. April, May. "On March 29th, April 7th, April 29th, and May 5th, deadly terrorist attacks, which together took the lives of 12 Israelis, were launched by individuals hailing from Nablus and Jenin." These are, if you remember First Intifada and the start of that, a lot of the battles, the initial battles, took place up here in this region of Nablus, Jenin, close to where Shechem is, or Shechem, right beneath Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, if that means something to you. These attacks placed the areas in question on the radar of Israeli security forces. Nearly nightly raids into these cities have followed. So for the past 3 months, Israeli authorities have ventured into these places and trying to weed out the terrorists. And they've killed 100 Palestinians, arrested around 1,500 as well. Nevertheless, the attacks continued upward, he writes. Figures released by the Shin Bet, Israel's security agency, in late September, so just 10 or 12 days ago, show a total of 212 attacks. This is, I mean, you probably haven't heard of this. You probably think of the occupation of what Israel's doing, perhaps, to the Palestinians. But just consider the number of this. In late September, they talked about this. There was a total of 212 attacks so far this year, such as throwing Molotov cocktails, pipe bombs, stabbings. That month, compared to 172 in August and 113 in July, there were 34 shooting attacks in September. 34 shooting attacks. Palestinians against Israelis. 34 shooting attacks in September, compared to 23 in August and 15 in July. Two Israelis, a soldier and a civilian, were killed in September. So this is obviously a deteriorating situation in Israel. We'll see if it spirals out of control or not. But right now, it doesn't look to be quieting down. Israel is currently searching for somebody that killed a border policeman. And so they're going into different towns in East Jerusalem to try and find that. And you saw some footage there of the greeting, the reception that they're getting from the Palestinians. So what does this all mean and what might it portend? Deterioration to a new 2000 to 2004, that's the second intifada when thousands of Israelis died, or over 1,000, style insurgency shouldn't be ruled out. And then he says that considering this is largely undirected, as far as we know right now, it might die down, but we'll see. One thing that we do know is that God tells us to watch Jerusalem, specifically watch for this event of half of Jerusalem falling. This is found, this prophecy, in Zechariah chapter 14. The very first couple of verses of that chapter discuss how there are events, three in particular, it says there, that culminate in the coming of the Messiah or the second coming of Christ. And this is explained in this wonderful booklet by Mr. Flory, The Internal Has Chosen Jerusalem. It has some of the bad news, I would say, of the peace process and why that's a deadly wound for Israel. It talks about half of Jerusalem falling, but it also discusses the inspiring roots of the city of Jerusalem and the fact that the city itself in its name is a prophecy of what is about to take place there, the city of peace. Now, one thing is for sure, and you, of course, can get all the literature by going to our website, thetrumpet.com, and you can hit the literature tab in the top and just scroll down to find The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem, a beautiful book that came out just a couple of years ago by Mr. Flory. Again, showing you the prophetic events we're watching for and that you should be watching for as well, and then the hope that lies within those prophecies. Now, one thing is for sure, and that is that violence in Jerusalem, violence in Israel, more broadly, Palestinian or Arab on Jew violence, on the eve of an election, is not good for the incumbent. The incumbent caretaker prime minister right now, we talked about yesterday, Yair Lapid, it's not looking good for him. If you've got violence like this and other problems that we'll talk about briefly, it's not looking good for him retaining the prime ministership. Of course, he's just a caretaker prime minister, meaning that the right now the government has complete dysfunction and it's heading towards an election. That's not stopping him from attempting to ram through some majorly important decisions and kind of like pushing that on the Israeli public. This is an article, Poll Split. It's either more deadlock or Netanyahu victory. And so this is interesting. This is from today, Jewish News Service, or Jewish News Syndicate, I should say, by David Isaac. He writes this. Two surveys this week, a Wednesday Mako Knesset channel poll, and Tuesday's Channel 11 iteration, Give Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud-led coalition 60 seats, one short of what it needs to form a government. 60 would be split. Israel would go back to another election. 120 seats in the Knesset. Forecasting yet another deadlock following the November 1st election. On the other hand, two polls from October 6th by Ma'ariv and Channel 14 found that the opposition leader, that is Benjamin Netanyahu, cobbling together 61 and 62 seats respectively, enough to form a government. Two elements may work in Netanyahu's favor are a deteriorating security situation, what we talked about in the first part of today's program, and the maritime border deal with Lebanon. The latter, talking about this deal we discussed yesterday, JNS is told, was an attempt by the current Prime Minister Yair Lapid to present a diplomatic achievement ahead of the election, but it may have backfired. So we have both of these things. Mordechai Keter of Bar Ilan University, he's quoted here, saying the security situation is definitely part of it. When it's unsafe and not secure, Israelis tend to vote more to the right. This is a permanent issue here in Israel. And on Tuesday, we had a drive-by shooting where an Israeli soldier was killed, and that followed another shooting on Saturday night where a soldier was killed, another was seriously wounded. So we have these crises that are besetting Israel right on the eve of this election, with Yair Lapid, the incumbent, going to take the flak for it. Now, I think it's interesting what we saw, what we discussed yesterday. A number of reports came in overnight from different news organizations, even the Wall Street Journal, talking about what an utter capitulation this was to a Hezbollah-led Lebanon and to the Biden administration, both. You'll recall that we talked about yesterday, you can go back and watch that if you so desire, that basically Israel was trying to demarcate or draw a line of its border and Lebanon and the border between Israel and Lebanon to the north out into the ocean, and it happens to go right through this potentially lucrative gas field, the Qana gas field. And so what you had then, this being negotiated, I'll just quote from this article just for 1 second. It says, U.S.-mediated negotiations between Israel and Lebanon to reach an agreed-upon maritime border over gas-rich waters, which they both claimed lie in their exclusive economic zone, began under the Obama administration about 10 years ago. Then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo revived them in 2020. So if it's something that the Obama administration is pushing, it's going to be something that the Biden administration is pushing. And that's what we see. Biden pushed Israel to give 100% of the gas field. So the line went way further south on this. I think it's line 23. They get all the rights to the gas field, even though part of it does travel through where Israel is designated to have its border. Nevertheless, Lebanon, Hezbollah-led Lebanon, gets 100% of it. There are some opportunities for Israel, apparently, to get some financial benefit from it down the road, but we'll see. This article, and again, this is all about the election that's coming, okay? Biden realized he has 3 weeks to ram this deal through to get Yair Lapid to sign off on a deal. It's not even going to go to the Knesset, it seems, to be voted on, to ram through this deal that is going to cut, I think, what was it, 500 nautical miles out of potential Israeli territory. This is new land for peace, except it's not land, it's water. Water for peace. Apparently, that's what's meant to happen. Hezbollah threatened to blow up the other gas field of Israel. And so Israel backs down, pressured by the Biden administration, and they're going to get almost all of the gas field. There might be an opportunity again for Israel to receive some of the financial benefit down the road. But if there's no financial benefit that's derived, if there's no actual drilling that's ever done by the backward Lebanese government right now, that is just total disarray. Lebanon is a shambles right now, unfortunately, for the citizens of Lebanon. If that doesn't ever happen, what just happened then? Oh, Israel just gave away some of its land to Hezbollah-led or Iranian-backed Lebanon. Obviously, this is something that is horrific for Israel's security situation, and it was something that was pushed by the Biden administration, as we talked about yesterday. Now, continuing here, this is quoting Adam Milstein Michael Milstein, sorry. He's a commentator about Israeli-Palestinian affairs. He writes this. Seems that the current elections will be dependent this time dramatically on the Arab vote. So this is the one thing that we don't know about. Will the Arabs come out and vote? If they come out and vote, it would swing this because that would be in, you know, on taking the side of Lapid away from Netanyahu. If they do come out to vote, then what's going to happen? Now, this is something that could happen. If you reminisce a little bit, if you can recall, in 2015, there was commentary going on during the election in 2015. This is what Netanyahu would end up winning. However, he took to social media election day, and he said that the Arabs are coming out to vote in droves. And, you know, Western media got caught of this and was like, well, what's wrong with that? That the Arabs are coming out to vote in droves. You racist, Netanyahu. But what was happening behind the scenes is that the Obama-led State Department was funding an NGO called V15, connected with another one called One Voice. And they were funding this NGO to take buses and go to towns in Israel that typically wouldn't vote and induce them. Hey, come and vote. We've got your own transport worked out. All you have to do is get in, come with us, and vote in this election. Now, this is highly irregular, if not illegal, probably illegal. And the fact that the United States was the one funding this organization that was working it out to try and get rid of Netanyahu. We have a similar situation that could potentially come up right now. Only 40% or less seem motivated to come out and vote. We will see if that happens, but which it could. But right now, I think it is looking like Israel is going to elect Netanyahu, or at least the Likud party is going to be able to put together a coalition, barring something out of the ordinary, which we live in the age of out of the ordinary. So we'll see. I want to just briefly show you another story. This is interesting because Israel is constantly talked about as, you know, not wanting peace. And Israel comes back and says, well, the only partner for peace potentially that we could have that is not Hamas is Fatah, which is the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas. And if we can play clip two, and I'll speak over the top of it right now, this is what Mahmoud Abbas is doing today. What's he doing? Well, he's meeting with somebody that, you know, the West itself says is dictator-in-chief, is somebody, and he is a horrific leader that is destroying many civilians in the Ukraine. And that's him meeting Sergei Lavrov there as well, who's the foreign minister, Putin's foreign minister. And this is Mahmoud Abbas here on the eve of what we would, you know, right in the midst, I should say, of this onslaught in Ukraine. We have Israel's partner for peace going to Kazakhstan for a meeting that they have there and having a sit down with Putin. That is Israel's so-called partner for peace. Now, we could stop playing that now. It's on repeat, I think. But it's just a good reminder of what a deadly wound the peace process is. Mr. Flory writes about this in The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem, based on a prophecy found in Hosea chapter 5. And how Israel, if they're choosing to pursue a peace deal with people like this, I mean, how is that going to work out? Obviously, it's not. Now, before we get to Mr. Gerald Flory's address, there's one final story I wanted to bring to you, and I couldn't resist. This is not from Jerusalem. However, it's absolutely shocking. This was a speech, well, a question and answer session that took place in the European Parliament on Monday. So fairly fresh, pretty new. This is a stunning admission that was made by Pfizer executive Jeanine Small. So this isn't the head of Pfizer. I forget his name. I think he put out his minion to make this statement. But he was asked this question by Dutch MEP Rob Roos. And I don't know if you'll be shocked if you've watched this program, but it's an amazing and startling admission from the Pfizer executive, Jeanine Small. You can play the next clip.
And I will speak in English so there are no misunderstandings. Was the Pfizer COVID vaccine tested on stopping the transmission of the virus before it entered the market? If not, please say it clearly. If yes, are you willing to share the data with this committee? And I really want a straight answer, yes or no, and I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Regarding the question around, did we know about stopping immunisation before it entered the market? No. We had to really move at the speed of science to really understand what is taking place in the market.
This is scandalous. Millions of people worldwide felt forced to get vaccinated because of the myth that you do it for others. Now, this turned out to be a cheap lie. This should be exposed.
So this is Dutch MEP, member of European Parliament, Rob Roos, asking her, and it does. It turns out to be a lie. They had no data. No data on whether the Pfizer vaccine would actually be effective at stopping transmission. Now, this is, you know, the whole basis for the Green Pass system. I remember in Israel several times. I mean, I didn't have the vaccine. And so, you know, if I wanted to go anywhere, Hebrew University, if I wanted to go to an outdoor event with my family, I have to get tested within 24 hours of it. I was turned away from an outdoor event. I walked down all these stairs. This is into the Valley of Hinnom. They've got a fair for children or whatever. And I go down there with all these stairs, maybe a couple hundred stairs, with my pram, my double stroller, my three kids. We get to the bottom. It's outdoors. Where is your green pass? Cartesia Rock, where is your green pass? We weren't allowed in. Why? Because we were considered a threat, because we hadn't had the vaccine. And the vaccine is meant to keep you from transmitting the virus from somebody else. And Pfizer, it was all over Israel. That's number one for Israel. Well, that turned out to be a flat-out lie. As Mr. Flurry likes to say on this program, they lie. They lie. They knew it was a lie. They knew that it wouldn't impact. Well, they would say they couldn't keep, they had to move fast like science. She laughs about it. She laughs about this question. What do you mean? What a silly question. We just had to go so quick with this vaccine that we had no time to test it. So if they didn't have time to test it, to see whether it was transmissible, how much time did they have to test it to see if it was going to have detrimental impacts on people that took it? It's absolutely shocking. That again was Chief Executive Janine Small of Pfizer admitting that the vaccine at the start, at least they didn't know whether it would actually help reduce transmission of the virus before it entered the market. Okay, enough of that. Something so much more hopeful. This was the opening remarks by the founder of the Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology in Jerusalem. This is an archaeology institute that we're dedicated to revitalizing biblical archaeology in Israel. We have a 50-year history working in Jerusalem ever since that Six-Day War and Israel got control of East Jerusalem, working right alongside one of the presidents of Hebrew University, Benjamin Mazar, and his granddaughter, the late Eilat Mazar. And it was actually one of the desires of Eilat Mazar going back about 6 years now, that we develop an institute for archaeology and that she would work with us. Sadly, she's sorely missed. She's no longer with us. However, God is moving forward with his plans here with the opening of this archaeology institute. So here he is, Mr. Gerald Flurry, the founder of the Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology, at the opening in Jerusalem on September 4th. And this is where I'll leave you.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
This is certainly a very special day for us here, and we're just happy to have all of you with us. I wanted to take a little different angle than the other speakers to tell you a little bit about our history with not only history of Mr. Armstrong, but the Israeli leaders as well. In that one decade, he met all of the leaders of Israel, as far as I can tell, and he, of course, was the founder of Ambassador College. It all began with Dr. Benjamin Mazar launching this most significant excavation ever in Jerusalem. And so that's something that's very impressive. And then December 1968, Hebrew University and the Antiquities Authority and Mr. Armstrong made a 50-50 financial deal and began this magnificent excavation that still astonishes a lot of people. Dr. Mazar had been president of Hebrew University for 8 years. As we've got into this, we find there's quite a lot of controversy in archaeology, as there is other professions. Well, I want to show you something that I think is really rare, and that is the relationship with the Israeli leaders and Herbert W. Armstrong. I think it's a history that I studied into more deeply, and it's a history that really, I think, is worth remembering and has some tremendous lessons for us. And of course, we all have different ideas about that, but still, in this sense, it is our history, any way you look at it. So I want to discuss the relationship between the Israeli leaders and Mr. Armstrong. I'm just going to quickly go through some slides here, and I won't take up much time for this, but we can begin with the first one. This is where it all began, and you can see Dr. Mazar and Mr. Armstrong talking together. And then the second one, this is Dr. Mazar. They had an honorary dinner by the Japanese ambassador to Israel in 1974. The two men enjoyed a close friendship for many years. Then number three, this is Mayor Teddy Kollek, arm in arm, a Jewish custom among close friends. And then Prime Minister Golda Meir. Mr. Armstrong gave her a beautiful Steuben crystal there in the Knesset office. And he had this to say about her, and I wanted to mention this. He said, "Without apology to anyone, I have to attribute to this so common, yet so uncommon, a woman, humanly, the quality of greatness such as possessed by so very few." And then he said emphatically, "That is not flattery. I never flatter." And that's the way he felt about that great leader. And this next one is Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. I'll say a little bit more about him later. And then this last one is Menachem Begin hugging Mr. Armstrong. And he, on that occasion, had returned from a meeting in Tel Aviv
And he stopped in the meeting and left when he heard that Mr. Armstrong was in town. And he went up there to meet him, and they gave him this big bear hug. And then Mr. Armstrong said, well, you shouldn't have left your meeting coming just to meet me. And he said, Mr. Armstrong, I would get up at 2 a.m. in the morning to meet you. So here we have an interesting history to me, and the more I studied into this particular subject and tried to clarify it as much as I could in my own mind, Mr. Armstrong visited Jerusalem 50 times in 4 years, to give you an idea of how much he loved Jerusalem. And I think all of the Israeli leaders also that he worked with loved Jerusalem, and that's why I think they had an unusual harmony. And in looking into it, I began to try to study their conversations between themselves mainly. This was not going to the public, not at least at that time. And I think you'll find it surprising what they said to each other and what they talked about. Now, I find that very interesting, and I hope the rest of you will. It's something that I think many people should know, and I think there's almost nobody that really understands this and really has put these issues together. When Mr. Armstrong was here, he did refer to the Bible. He never did refer to any Bible but the Hebrew Bible. These discussions began, let's say, just among these leaders, but then in 1974, somebody made it public, and that was Dr. Mazar. He wanted people to know what they were talking about, what they believed, and they shared a certain faith that I think can be very helpful, especially in an age like this. But here's what Mr. Armstrong said. He said, Ambassador College has just been given the great honor and responsibility to be a part of this archaeology planning here in Israel. And he says, not only a great honor, it is a great honor, it's a great honor to us to be a part of this. And it is, in our minds, a spectacular archaeology project that we've been involved with. Mr. Armstrong went on to talk about this responsibility. And I think in one sense, this great honor and responsibility, especially the responsibility, has a lot to do with this institution today. I think a big part of it is this institute, because we felt like we do have a responsibility to try to sustain biblical archaeology. And it really, in some ways, is not as nearly as successful as it should be, the way we look at it. So I want to give you just some quotes, quite a few quotes today, of just that from these men, and they were really just mostly, as I said, among themselves at this time. And then see what you think about what they said. Now, I'm not trying to preach to you. I'm just trying to tell you some history. This is our history and the history of many others around here and around here today. Mr. Teddy Kollek presented Mr. Armstrong with a silver and gold sculpture of David defeating Goliath. And he said to Mr. Armstrong, all your life you have been a fighter of giant untruths. And he said, and as you regard yourself a descendant of David, and rightly so here in the city of David, we would like to present you with this symbolic sculpture. And here's what Mr. Armstrong replied. Jerusalem was destined to become the greatest city in the world. And in fact, in the whole universe, this city is someday going to be the capital of the universe, because this city is going to exist forever. Now, again, I'm just letting you see what they were discussing. This was not public at all at that time. But that's a strong statement to make. And what it kind of amazes me talking about this is that you find a lot of agreement, or at least no negative reactions to what Mr. Armstrong said. These men really were in a fascinating harmony, I thought, because you don't usually take a group like that and put them together and have them be so, let's say, in sync, I guess I can say, with each other, as these men were. Here's a Prime Minister Perez, who said, talking about the King of Jordan, well, he really does want peace, but he has internal problems, and they were discussing that, and Mr. Armstrong said to him, this is the Prime Minister Perez. Mr. Armstrong responded that although more troubles were coming, world peace would ultimately come, but it isn't going to come easy. Now, those are, Mr. Armstrong is making these comments to the top leaders in Israel. And then we'll see as we go along that they really do love each other and have a certain faith in what they're talking about. In November 1974, the banquet there in Tel Aviv, this was an honor to Mr. Armstrong. At last, it was going public. But why did it go public? And that is fascinating as well. Dr. Mazar, he wanted this released, and you know, they had officials there, parliamentarians, ambassadors, diplomats, and national journalists. They heard from Dr. Mazar, and here's what he told them. Now, this is what he said, and he was not in any way motivated by Mr. Armstrong to do this. This is what Dr. Mazar says. And he even used a scripture, just paraphrases it. But primarily, he has a firm faithfulness, as I think these leaders did. In the prophecy of Isaiah, paraphrasing Isaiah 2, verses 2 and 3. And here's what it said. I'll just paraphrase it. And it shall come to pass in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and be exalted above the hills. And then it goes on to say, all nations shall flow into it. All nations. That's in, I think, the Bible most of you have. And think about this, what he's saying. This is what Mr. Armstrong talked about, and he's paraphrasing it, and somehow he wants to make this public. Now that you'll have to read your own issues into that, but he goes on to say, many people shall go up and come, let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, and then it says, and he will teach us of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. Mr. Armstrong and these men were thinking beyond, let's say, just biblical archaeology, but they were believing certain prophecies, and this is not a unique prophecy in your Bible. You'll find it there probably about 20 times, the same prophecy in many ways. But here there are all these nations, it says, are coming to be taught at Jerusalem. And that's going to bring peace to this world. Now, that's in Isaiah, and I think you're all probably familiar with that. And he said, Mr. Armstrong has a certain faithfulness. But they did, too. They did, too. But I think you can imagine, let's just say if somebody believes Isaiah 2 and verses 2 and 3, they're going to be motivated, I think, to have a certain hope in their lives. And I bring that out because this is our history, and these men, I believe, had a special hope in their lives because Dr. Mazar is trying to get this out to everybody. And I'm not saying anybody should believe anything. I'm just saying this is a part of the Bible that a lot of people believe and are happy to hear something like that, I think. But the key part of this, I thought, was here is Mr. Armstrong taking all of this archaeology and connecting it to Isaiah 2, verses 2 and 3. Obviously, he was interested in more than just biblical archaeology, but he did not take this to the public himself. Dr. Mazar did. Why did he do that? Well, maybe you and I will have to answer that individually, but he did get it out there, and he did think in his own mind, along with certainly some of those other leaders, quite a few of them I would think, they wanted this message to get out to the people of Israel. It is, after all, taken from the Bible, the Hebrew Bible. But he goes on to say in this public statement, he said, Mr. Armstrong loves and admires Jerusalem, and wholeheartedly he believes in the future of Israel and the holy city. And for him, Jerusalem, the unified Jerusalem, is not only the metropolis of Israel and the spiritual center of monotheistic religions, but also the symbol of a great past and the hope of a better future of mankind. Now, that I found that moving, because you see the problems in the world that I see. We all see them. But you don't see, in my mind, a lot of hope. And what are we going to do without hope? I don't think we're going to be doing maybe the positive things we should. Somewhere, we do need to find hope. And I think most of these men, these leaders of Israel, at that time believed what Mr. Armstrong was saying, and they were reacting to it in a very positive way, and most of the time. But again, I don't know every detail of this, but to me, they looked upon Jerusalem as being a city of hope. Now, that is something that I thought was interesting, because it is a part of the history, and some of it even I didn't understand myself, but it's all there, and it's and if you put it all together, well, I feel like if people didn't have that, let's say, know all of the history, they might begin to think, when they only had a tiny portion of the information, they might tend to misinterpret it. So I think it can be a help to certain people. And I think it's good for all of us to think about. But you will have to decide that yourself, of course. This is from Herbert Armstrong. I wanted you to get his take on this, how unusual it was that they were so in harmony here. How could it happen that they were so together and believed many similar truths as we look at it? Mr. Armstrong said this: the favor we were given in their eyes, the warmth of their attitude toward us, was inspiring, astonishing, and most unusual. And I think it is. It's an unusual example. I think it is getting more unusual. But that's the kind of something, they did know something about world peace. And I'll just conclude by talking briefly about what Mr. Armstrong did. He was called the ambassador for world peace by these people. And he was called that because he met over 30 leaders of the world, and not one of them did he approach to visit with them. But they were leaders that wanted to know, to speak to somebody who they believed understood something about world peace, how to have it and how we'll never have it until, well, no matter how much we reject it according to the Hebrew Bible, well, you're going to have peace. We're going to have world peace. And I don't think that's something that's bad. Here is what this brochure, I got this from February 4th, 1975, bulletin, and it said This brochure is to present in a pictorial fashion the activities of Mr. Armstrong throughout the world during the past 7 years as an ambassador for world peace, a term that people such as Prince Mikasa of Japan, Ambassador Ron of Israel, Minister Cole of Israel, Dr. Singh of the International Court, and others have used publicly to describe the work of Herbert W. Armstrong. Now, that work started almost exactly the time of this great archaeology project we're talking about. And the Israelis, even that, believed there really was a real message coming from this unofficial ambassador for world peace, and that name was given to him by other people, not himself. Margaret Thatcher, just to name a few, Deng Xiaoping, Anwar Sadat, Hosni Mubarak, and many, many others. But Mr. Armstrong would go to those people that these leaders really desperately saw that we need world peace. I mean, we can look around. I see this world and I see a need for world peace. Somebody is surely going to speak out and, well, maybe talk about Isaiah 2, verses 2 and 3. That is a strong statement, and there are strong prophecies like that. And here's what these men said in the end toward Mr. Armstrong. This is from Yitzhak Rabin. He says, "But of course, I know a great deal about you," talking about Mr. Armstrong. "We all do deeply appreciate your interest in Israel." He had a great interest in Israel and just boldly said one time that his first next 1,000 years he's going to be living here in Jerusalem. Well, that's the kind of faith he had, and these men are praising him for that, and I think had similar ideas. But he said, "During the 45-minute meeting, the two leaders discussed Mr. Armstrong's friendship with Arab chiefs of state and peace among nations. And Prime Minister Rabin thanked Mr. Armstrong for bringing other nations closer to Israel, especially the Arab nations." And you remember the story of Anwar Sadat and all of that. I think all of you are familiar with that. But he says, you brought those people closer to us. This is a prime minister saying that. This is one of your leaders. It's not somebody that's just doesn't know what he's talking about. After he said these words, Mr. Armstrong said this. He was very appreciative of my efforts toward world peace. And I think that's certainly a noble cause. And I think those Israeli leaders were trying very hard to have peace. And you ask Mrs. Mayer about what do you need most of all? And she said, "What we need most of all is peace. What can we do if we don't have peace? We're going to be tearing things apart and tearing each other apart. Somehow we have to learn to have peace and have hope." And the Hebrew Bible is just full of statements about that, as I think most of you know. But anyhow, just in conclusion, regardless of our archaeology views, I believe these leaders can teach us some lessons. I think we need to be aware of it. After all, it's a part of my history, and I wanted to make sure I understood it the best I could, and I've tried to relay that to you here today. And I think, after all, we people can push that aside or whatever they want to do, but still, it is a part of our history, and I think it's worthwhile talking about from time to time. It's been very nice talking to you today.